I'm going to share with you this afternoon a personal Bible study that came to mind as we were preparing for and have been enjoying having our family with us on this Thanksgiving weekend. Rochelle and Eric and the kids came in on Wednesday night, and then Ryan and Kylie and their two boys came on Thursday morning, and Laurel and Sharon, who are Kylie's parents, members in the Weaving congregation, came up for dinner as well on Thursday. So we had, in our case, a kind of a traditional family get-together, and it was a very special day. It's always exciting with all the children and all their activities and all their busyness. It adds a lot to the feeling of it being a family feast. On a smaller level, it reminded me of the Thanksgivings we used to have when we were living out on the West Coast with five younger brothers, most of them at the time married, children. We would get together at my parents' home, and there'd be anywhere between 20 to 25 of us usually for a typical Thanksgiving get-together with the family. And there's one mental picture I have, an image I have in my head of the Thanksgiving meal. You've all seen these nature videos where you see the carcass of some animal consumed by piranha. Somehow it falls out of the canoe or stumbles into the river, and there's this flurry of activity in the waters moving, and then suddenly in about 10 seconds there's just a carcass or just bones, skeleton floating down the river. A lot like my family at Thanksgiving. Mom would put the turkey out on the table, and everybody would gather around it, and there'd be this jostling and rustling and all this activity, and then you step back in about 5 minutes and there's this skeleton of a turkey sitting on the table. So I have those memories of the big family feasts. We've changed our traditions and our family size a bit since we moved out here, but it's very satisfying to have as many of our family together as we can. Didn't see a lot of football. That was the one thing that was not as traditional and normal. I snuck downstairs to catch the score a couple of times. There is a certain degree of satisfaction whenever the Cowboys get beaten. So that added somewhat to the day as well. So it was a very pleasant day. I hope that you were also able to enjoy your day of Thanksgiving. Every family has different circumstances and different situations. Sometimes they're gathering larger or smaller groups, but it is a day that's been designated as a special one, and one that we generally try to enjoy in a special way, each family with its own circumstances and traditions. But before and during the weekend itself, there was a scripture that came to mind that, in fact, Mr. Ingram mentioned it in the sermonette. It's Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5. This verse brings together a couple of important principles that I think relate, as Mr. Ingram pointed out, to our prayers and our relationship with God, our appreciation for what God has given us, and also connects that to our faith and the importance of having trust that what God has blessed us with is sufficient and it is adequate, and we feel that we recognize that He would never leave us without caring for us, and that we can be content with what He has given. Hebrews 13, verse 5. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for He Himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? This verse relates both a sense of being content, being satisfied, of appreciating what God has given, and also, as I said, it connects us with the sense of being having faith and confidence in God, because we know that He will always provide for us. We've all gone through the exercise at one time or another of trying to identify what it is that we're the most thankful for. And we, of course, recognize that most of our most important blessings are spiritual in nature, because it makes everything else in our life, all the physical blessings, makes them make sense and gives them some purpose, rather than just providing some short-term comfort or satisfaction. So we know that our blessings are mostly or primarily on a spiritual level. But still, we know, also know that the physical blessings that we have make our lives enjoyable and make our lives comfortable. And we certainly look forward to, we anticipate, and we're thankful for those physical blessings as well. For example, you may not have thought of it consciously this morning, but I'm sure that on some level, as you rolled out of bed and looked outside and saw the snow on the ground and saw the snow falling, that you were very thankful for your furnace. It's a comfort, and it's something that if we didn't have, and certainly some of those to our east where the hurricane hit so badly or so hit them so hard, have experienced what it's like to do without those seemingly little comforts. So we realize that, yes, for the most part, our blessings, our greatest blessings, are spiritual, but yet we're physical, and much of what we experience and much of what we are comforted with and satisfied by are also physical. We might turn back to Proverbs chapter 30, a familiar verse. You may not know where it was exactly, but I'm sure that you're familiar with the content or the message of this verse. Proverbs chapter 30, verse 8. We'll start in the middle. It says, "Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food allotted to me, lest I be full and deny you and say, 'Who is the Lord?' Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God." Certainly an acknowledgement that, you know what, there are some physical blessings that we do need, that we count on God to provide. There's a certain basic set of necessities that we have. We often say that money cannot buy happiness. Well, it's true in the intent or the way that it's meant, that meaning that it can't ultimately make you happy. However, there are some basic and fundamental needs that we have. And unless those immediate needs are met, you know, food, shelter, clothing, job, whatever the basics of life might be, we do need to have those. And if we don't, we're going to be insecure. We're going to have some difficulty. So this proverb here kind of points out that balance that, you know, God, give me what I need so that I won't, resent or be a beggar or be in difficult physical circumstances, but not too much so that I won't forget you. Remember the warning that God gave to Israel when they came into their promised land? He said, when you move into this land and when you receive the blessings and when you're wealthy and strong as a nation, don't forget your God, which of course they did. But there's that balance that is necessary in order to be physically comfortable, so that we can look to other higher level satisfaction and needs. But back to Hebrews 13, verse 5, in this verse, again, we find two very important principles that are closely related. The first is that we should be content with the things that we know God has provided us with. Because, again, look at the way it's worded, be content with such things as you have, for He Himself has said to you. In other words, be content because God has made a promise to us, and that is that He would never leave us or forsake us. And so that means that what we do receive, the condition or the situation we do have, is one in which God is involved, and if there is frankly, a need or a difficulty, it's not because God has abandoned us. It's because God is helping us to learn some other very important lessons. So the title I've given to the message this afternoon is on the next page here, next screen. The title is Be Content and Trust God. Be content and trust God. Now, if we think about it, neither of those is natural. It's not natural for us to be content. It's not the human way of thinking to be. Now, we may have learned that lesson. We may have come to this point where we are content, but it's not that it was natural. It is something that we need to learn and something that we need to remember, to continue to recognize that we ought to be content. Paul is pretty basic about it. In 2 Timothy 6, he says, or 1 Timothy 6, he says, having food and clothing, be content. Now, that's pretty basic. If you got food and you got some clothes on your back and you can survive this Pittsburgh winter, then we ought to be content. That's very basic. That's not natural to us. By nature, we tend to quickly become accustomed to what we have. We might receive something or have something or find something that is new to us, and we're very pleased with it, and we recognize it as a real blessing. But what we thought would be so satisfying sometimes will eventually leave us wanting something else. Because we become accustomed to what we have, and we start looking for more that will be newer or enjoyable to us as well. Many times we've noted the irony that there's this day set aside as a national day of thanksgiving, to give thanks for all the bounty and the blessings and the prosperity that God has given to us as a nation. And that same day marks the beginning of the shopping frenzy for the next holiday. When people suddenly are finally going out looking for things either for someone else or for themselves that will really, really make them thankful. Because they realize, or advertisers have helped us to realize that we're not happy at all. There's some things that we need that we have to get right away so that we can really, really be happy. And then guess what? By next Thanksgiving, those are all going to be the old stuff, and we'll have to start all over again. Now, I say we. I don't think that we are caught up in that in the same way that others are. But you see that part of human nature at work. Used to be, of course, that shopping season began the day after Thanksgiving, which was ironic enough, but now it actually begins before Thanksgiving. Some of these big sales started a day or two or during the week leading up to Thanksgiving. Other stores were open on Thursday night, and it was only the stores that are behind everybody else that waited actually until Friday morning to begin having their big Black Friday sales. Today, by the way, is Small Business Saturday. Maybe you've heard that. Everybody today is supposed to shop at the small businesses to show our support for them. And then, of course, day after tomorrow is Cyber Monday, and we're all supposed to go online and purchase our go to Amazon.com or all those other online vendors and get what we really, 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 really want on Monday. Not sure what happened to Sunday. I guess it's maybe kind of a national day of worshiping the football league, and so not so much happening on Sunday. But this big shopping season is just getting underway, and we're all going to be You know, bad enough, I guess it was worse to see all those political commercials, but now we have all the insulting and just simply stupid Santa Claus commercials. You know, Santa Claus sells cars, or whatever else we see. It's just the advertising is truly juvenile and insulting, but it works, I suppose, because there a lot of money and resource goes into convincing us of what we really need to make us happy. The word content that's used here in Hebrews 13 is from a Greek word which means to be happy as the result of having what one needs. To be happy as the result of having what one needs. Or in other words, to be satisfied with our condition. Being content has to do with recognizing that what we have is sufficient. That what we have is enough to take care of our needs. And God, because He has promised to never leave us or forsake us, will always provide what we need. That's a definition from the Lao and Nida lexicon. I've got a couple of comments from the commentaries that I think also help us to understand and appreciate the promise that God has made to us and the importance of being content. From the Adam Clark commentary, he makes a comment on the phrase that I will never leave you nor forsake you. These words are not a direct quote from any particular scripture, but the principle is given in other situations as well. The promise from God that He would provide and that He would not forsake those to whom He has made promises. Let's look at a couple of examples where a similar phrase is used. One is in Genesis 28, verse 5. Genesis 28, Genesis 28, 15. Genesis 28, 15. This is a statement that God made directly to Jacob. Remember, Jacob was a kind of a rascal. He was the younger of the two twins, and he was always kind of contentious with his barely older brother Esau, and wrestled with him even before birth, indicating the kind of personality he would have. And his name means to supplant or to take something that wasn't really his. And so we know that, you know, Jacob was basically chased out of his own household because he had stolen his brother's blessing and then stolen his birthright. So they had to get him out of there quickly, so he would his life would not be endangered by his brother Esau. After he fled from his home, he stopped along the way and he had this dream. You're familiar with that, verse 10. He was at a certain place and the sun set, and he laid his head on a stone to use it as a pillow. And then he had a dream of the angels coming and going from God's throne. In verse 13, behold, the Lord stood above what he saw there, the angels ascending and descending. He said, I am the Lord your God, or the God of Abraham your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your descendants. So the blessing or the promises made to Abraham are being passed along to Jacob. At this point, he was very unconverted, and he was beginning now. God's beginning to work directly in his life to bring him, to help him become a different kind of person, to begin to look to God. We'll drop down to verse 15. This is part of the message then that God has for Jacob. Behold, I'm with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. So a similar promise is made to Jacob, that God is going to bring him back to this area, that his descendants would live on this land, the same promise that had been made to Abraham, and I will not leave you until I have completed, I've done what I've promised that I would do. So it's a similar kind of a promise then that God made to Jacob. The instance that we're most familiar with is in the book of Joshua. Joshua, of course, succeeded Moses in leading Israel. Moses brought them up to the land of promise, and Joshua brought them across into the land of promise. Moses died without having entered the land. Verse 1 of Joshua 1, or verse 2 says, Moses, my servant, is dead. Therefore, arise and go over this river Jordan, you and all the people, to the land which I am giving to them. So God had chosen Joshua to continue the work that he had been doing through Moses. And you have to believe, even though Joshua probably was a very qualified man, one who in whom God had worked for some time to prepare him for this, must have been a very intimidating or overwhelming responsibility to suddenly have the same level of responsibility that Moses had. It probably was something that really caused him to stop and to consider what God was going to be asking of him. Verse 5, the encouragement of Joshua begins. It says, no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so will I be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and of good courage, for to this people you shall divide an inheritance. So Joshua had to do his part, which was to obey God and to be courageous enough to do that, to follow his instructions. But God gave him the promise that he would never leave nor forsake him. Again, the phrase is used in a similar way in 1 Chronicles chapter 28. 1 Chronicles chapter 28 and in verse 20. This is the occasion where David was giving instructions to Solomon to build the temple. Solomon, we know, felt much too small for the task when he became the king of Israel. We know that in 1 Kings 3, Solomon prays and he says that I'm but a child, I don't know how to come in or go out. And he was seeking God's help in being able to rule the people of God, the nation of God. So he was also, frankly, in need of encouragement when David spoke to him of the responsibilities that would be put upon him. So David said to his son Solomon, 1 Chronicles 28:20, be strong and of good courage and do it. He's speaking of building the temple. Do not fear nor be dismayed, for the Lord God, my God, will be with you. Interesting how David phrased that. Solomon, perhaps as well, had never really embraced God and had the confidence in God and the faith in God that he should have. We know his life went off in the wrong direction later. But the promise is made that the God, my God, will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you until you have finished all the work for the service of the house of the Lord. So again, the encouragement is given to Solomon. So the summary or the paraphrase that we have in Hebrews 13 is from that concept, that when God makes a promise to an individual or to a people, then he will never abandon that promise. And he will never abandon the people to whom that promise is given. So the writer here in Hebrews actually extends that promise in principle to Christians, to those of us who are following Jesus Christ. The Adam Clark commentary goes on to put it this way. He says, the words written here are especially emphatic. To give a literal translation is scarcely possible, but it would be something like this. No, I will not leave thee. No, neither will I utterly forsake thee. Notice that it's given, the positive promise is given in this negative, with these negative words. No, I will not leave you. No, neither will I utterly forsake thee. So that's the what our Adam Clark calls the genius of the Greek language, to be able to group these negatives together in one sentence, but it actually the result of it is to be a very positive and promising statement that is given with emphasis to affirm what God has stated and what has promised to do. So the principle is taken from those Old Testament examples and extended to us, that there is no condition under which God would forsake his people. And so the result of that, having that faith, then means that we are content with what God is doing for us. Now I would suggest, and maybe, what do they call it, making a distinction without a difference? I would suggest that being content means more than being thankful. To be thankful means to be grateful. And we know that there are scriptures that tell us to be thankful. We need to be thankful. We need to be grateful to God for what he has given to us. That kind of, in my mind, implies a list. Oh, here's the things that God has given that I appreciate. But to be content goes to our heart. It means that we are satisfied. It means that we are at peace. It means that we accept what God has provided as his will, as again, the sermonette, as Pat mentioned in the sermonette, that it is God's will and he is taking care of us. And it's kind of a circular thing in a way. The more we understand and appreciate that, then the more we trust God to never forsake us and to always provide the needs that we have. So I don't want to make a big deal out of it. I don't think that being thankful and content are different things. Maybe being content includes being thankful. Maybe that's how I would say it. There are a number of specific statements in Scripture that tell you be thankful, and so that is something that we recognize and that we certainly are willing to do. So contentment takes it, in a sense, I think, to the next level. Now also notice here in Hebrews 13:5 that being content is contrasted with covetousness. Let your conduct be without covetousness, but rather be content. Covetousness is one of those aspects of nature, of our human nature, that I think we might tend to oversimplify. It's not that we are covetous people, but I think our nature tends to covet or to desire things, and we have to keep that under control. I mean, after all, that's one of the Ten Commandments, right? You shall not covet. And then it lists a few things that are examples of things we should not desire. The word covetousness is defined by the Lawanida lexicon as being a strong desire to acquire more than is necessary. A strong desire to acquire more than is necessary. A synonym would be greed. It would be a word that we would use that would help to define covetousness. Again, when I said earlier that being content is not natural to us, unfortunately, being covetous is natural to us because we do often desire more than we really need, and we can sometimes consider our lives and kind of stretch the word need to include some things that we think are basic and important, And I'm sure God understands our desires, but covetousness is that desire out of control. And a true and deep sense of wanting something, desiring something that's more or beyond what is necessary. Or also would be a strong desire for something that is not ours to have, would be another aspect of coveting. But as we consider covetousness, it's one of those basic things that we need to understand. God does not want does not want that to be in our character at all. Look at the list that Paul gives us in Ephesians 5. He's talking about things that should not be even mentioned or would have no connection whatsoever to God's people. It says in verse 1, be imitators of God. Verse 2, walk in love, following Christ and his example. Verse 3, but fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you as is fitting for saints. In other words, it should be something that is just would never be put in the same sentence with a Christian, that is not associated with us at all, no any more than fornication or other sexual uncleanness would be. Don't let it even be named among you. It should be something that's completely distant from and apart from God's people. So again, we're reminded in Hebrews 13 to not be characterized by covetousness, our conduct be without covetousness, but instead to be content, to be satisfied, to be pleased, because God is taking care of us. Paul makes a similar statement in Colossians 3, verse 5. Colossians chapter 3, verse 5. This is the list that you may recall where he says these are natural tendencies or characteristics that we have that are part of our nature that we should put to death. Now, if something is put to death, it has no more influence, has no more, it's gone, it's completely eradicated. And it's a very strong statement. To put to death your members which are on the earth, or your natural nature, your natural tendencies and characteristics, things we would naturally tend to do, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness. It's just one of the basic elements of our nature which God instructs us frequently over and over again to eradicate. Now, I think that emphasis probably means that it's something that we have to make an effort to remove from our lives. It's not a simple thing. And so we can examine our motives, our desires, what we find important, and compare that to these basic instructions. Then it says that evil desire and covetousness, which is idolatry. To be covetous is a form of idolatry. So really there are a couple of commandments, direct commandments, that are violated by someone who has that kind of a selfishness about him and is in some way covetous rather than content. So it does give us pause, doesn't it? It gives us reason to stop and think. And to recognize that, yes, we're a thankful people, I believe. I believe that as a church, as God's people, we are thankful. And I think that much of the time we're content. But there's sometimes that we find ourselves wrestling and struggling to really have a sense of peace about our circumstances. And to recognize that this is, it's not always going to be this way. It doesn't mean that if we have a particular circumstance, a need, a trial, whatever, it doesn't mean it's always going to be that way. And yet, We recognize as we're experiencing different stages of life that God has not forsaken us, that this is where we are for now. We can pray for His hand in our lives to help us to get through those difficulties, those trials, look at Philippians chapter 4. This is an example of being thankful, which I think, you know, is part of being content. Ephesians 4, it should be a familiar verse, 6, be anxious for nothing. Anxiety is something that is sometimes difficult to control. Various reasons for being anxious and having anxiety, at the root of it is a lack of acceptance of that second half of Hebrews 5:13, that God will never leave us or forsake us. Somehow we sometimes become anxious about our circumstances and worry that maybe God has let something get out of control, or God doesn't care, or whatever the fear might be. But Paul says, don't be dominated by anxiety, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. It's not truly contradictory, but it contradicts our inclinations, our nature, to think that you could be content even while you're dealing with difficulties or with something that where you need to seek God's intervention. May not be thankful specifically for a difficulty, but yet we leave it in God's hands because we know that He would never forsake us. And we ask Him, realizing that we should be thankful for His hand in our lives and the many things that we do enjoy, still letting our requests be made known to Him. It's almost difficult to describe, and it's certainly not, again, part of our nature. If something is not the way we would like for it to be, then we tend to become anxious, and we tend to worry in a way that God is trying to relieve us of. We don't need to worry unnecessarily. So then how do we learn to be content? How can we learn to be content? Well, it seems to me, and I guess I'm only speaking for myself, that I could learn to be content if I had everything I wanted. And so there are times I actually, you know, I have to stop and catch myself that, you know, that's what I'm asking for. And am I going to be happy before I have everything that I want? Am I going to be content? How do we learn to be content? Wouldn't it be nice if we really could learn to be content if we had everything the way we want it to be? Well, that kind of takes us back to the beginning, because as soon as we had everything the way we want it to be, we'd want something different. We'd want something more or something else. So that's not really the answer to learning how to be content. Sadly, and I guess I say that with kind of tongue in cheek, we learn to be content by having to make do with what we have. We learn to be content by having or being willing to make do with what we have. Paul gives us that example very directly, right here in this same chapter where we're reading. Look at Philippians chapter 4. We'll drop down to verse 10. Paul, when Paul wrote this epistle to the Philippians, he was in jail. He was in prison. And life is not easy in prison, whether it was in his age or any other. And much of the support that people received, the resources they received, and the way the prisons were established in Paul's time, came from those outside the prison who sent things in support of the prisoner. Verse 10, Paul says, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again. The people in the church in Philippi had been supportive of Paul in physical things and showing their care for him. But for some reason, that had been interrupted. Not that they wanted it to be, but for some reason, they were not able to provide those physical things for him. And it says, though you did care, but you lacked opportunity. So there was a time when they supported him, showed care for him in physical ways, sending him care packages or whatever his needs might have been. And then they weren't able to for a while, and then they were able to once again. So Paul was thankful that those physical needs were being again supplied by his friends in that church. Verse 11, not that I speak in regard to need. In other words, it's not all about me and what I find that I need, but I've learned in whatever state I am to be content. I've learned that whatever the situation is, that I have to be willing to accept it. That's one of those things that's difficult for us to actually practice. Maybe there are certain areas in life where we do, but there are other areas in life, and we all have our own sensitivities, but there probably each of us has some area in our life where we tend to not be as patient as Paul is expressing here. Really, contentment, besides illustrating or demonstrating one who is appreciative of and accepting of and has peace of mind because in his condition, it also implies a great level of patience, because if our needs are not entirely met, or we think our needs are, then we can become impatient, which can express in many different ways. It can be frustration, it can be anger, it can be discouragement, but those are all signs of not being patient, as Paul had learned to be. So I've learned that in whatever state I'm in, to be content. I know how to be abased. I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things, I've learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So that willingness to accept the circumstances that Paul had learned, the contentment he was able to express, was based on what? His faith in Jesus Christ. Again, it goes back to that promise, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Paul understood that even though it wasn't exactly the way he wanted it to be, that he was willing to be patient and to recognize that Christ was the one who was going to accomplish what was necessary in his life and was watching over him. We might just back up again to verse 6. Be anxious for nothing, in supplication and by prayer, and by supplication and prayer. Let me just ask it this way. Why do we go to God in prayer? When we have a need, why do we go to God to ask Him to fill that need? It's because we trust that He would never leave us or forsake us. It's because we know that He's there. And we're continuing to seek that blessing even in those times of need. So Paul had learned in his times of difficulty the lesson of being content with what he did have and to lean on Jesus Christ, by whom he could do all things, to lean on the promise that God would never leave us or forsake us. So with Paul in mind, let's contrast that by going back again to Solomon. I think the contrast is one that you already understand, but let's go ahead and emphasize it here. The difference between the contentment that Paul learned because he suffered need with the dissatisfaction that Solomon experienced, even though he had every physical blessing that could be imagined. First of all, in chapter 1, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, we see here just the general dissatisfaction that Solomon has with life itself. And he expresses this himself by considering the different cycles that happen, and that nothing changes and nothing is accomplished and nothing good comes from it. He's so disillusioned here. Chapter 1, verse 2, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, referring to himself, "all is vanity," meaning empty or useless or pointless. That was his whole summation of life itself. "What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away, another generation comes, but the earth abides forever." So we just go through all these cycles of generations. They come and they go, they come and they go, but nothing changes. The earth just continues the way it always has. When the wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north, it comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, but the sea isn't full. It never seems to change the sea to have all those rivers running into it. "All things are full of labor," verse 9. We can't even express it. Life is just so futile. It's just hard work and difficult. We see the emptiness of Solomon's heart and the dissatisfaction he expresses about life itself. "The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing." We never are satisfied. It's this thing with the not being content. We have something and we want more. We see something, we never are satisfied with what we've seen. "That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun." So here's this philosophy of just the futility and emptiness is how he viewed life itself. And what a sad condition Solomon found himself to be in. So that much of that chapter, was we've reviewed it, kind of is his view, his philosophy of life. So now let's go on to chapter 2, and we'll see his view of absorbing or getting things in his life that would make him happy, the things that would make him happy. Chapter 2, verse 1. I'm going to read this to you from the New Living Translation. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. "I said to myself, come now, let's give pleasure a try. Let's look for the good things in life. But I found that this too was meaningless. It's silly to be laughing all the time, I said. What good does it do to seek only pleasure? After much thought, I decided to cheer myself with wine. While still seeking wisdom, I clutched at foolishness. In this way, I hoped to experience the only happiness most people find during their brief life in this world." Again, you see the futility in that being happy is not what is going to fulfill my life. And even cheering myself with wine, which is the only way that most people, he says, ever experience anything that's pleasurable or happy. "I also tried finding meaning by building huge homes for myself, by planting beautiful vineyards." You ever visited one of those mansions that were built by these great industrialists back in the early 1900s, maybe the Vanderbilt home down in, I guess, it's South Carolina. I haven't been there. My wife and I visited the Hearst Castle in San Simeon, California. It's on the Northern California coast. And William Randolph Hearst built his financial empire on newspapers. And he built not just a mansion, but a whole group of mansions up on this hillside overlooking the Pacific Ocean. At the foot of this hill, in order to guard his property, he had his own open terrain, kind of a zoo. And he had in that fenced area, just inside before he got up to his mansions, were tigers and lions and other wild animals that were just loose within this compound. And it was part of his security system to keep everybody else away from his castle. But you look at the homes that he built up there. He had these fabulous mansions with all kinds of innovations that were special or new back in the early 1900s. And it's just an incredible, talk about beyond what you need. You know, he had a whole building just for his swimming pool and dining rooms and guest houses with 20 bedrooms, and it's just huge, and all of it was very opulent and beautiful and rich. But Hearst died, and now his castle belongs to the state of California. And people pay $15 or $20 a piece just to walk through and look around, but there's nothing really of any value that ever came of this beautiful, incredible mansion that development that he accomplished. Solomon said, "I built myself huge homes and beautiful vineyards. I made gardens and parks, and I filled them with fruit trees. I built reservoirs to collect the water, to irrigate my flourishing groves." He had such developments. He had to build his own rivers to provide water to take care of the trees that he planted. "I bought slaves, men and women, and others were born into my household. I owned great herds and flocks, and more than any of the kings who lived in Jerusalem before me. I collected great sums of silver and gold, the treasure of many kings and provinces. I had all the wealth, the most fabulous wealth that could be imagined. I became greater than any of the kings who ruled before me." Verse 10, "Anything I wanted, I took." Talk about power. Talk about, was there anything he wanted that he couldn't have? No, he wanted it. If he couldn't buy it, he just took it. Couldn't build it, he took it. "Did not restrain myself from any joy." Verse 11, "But as I looked at everything I had worked so hard to accomplish, it was all so meaningless." Interesting contrast, isn't it? Paul found purpose, he found meaning, he found contentment while he was in prison and barely having enough resources to get through from one day to the next, waiting for the church to be able to send him a bit more. Solomon had every physical resource imaginable, and to him it was all just that much of a difficulty and pain. It was all so meaningless. It was like chasing the wind. There was nothing really worthwhile anywhere. This is an extreme example of one who is covetous, of one who is trying to find his satisfaction in a way that is purely physical. Contentment is a spiritual quality. It's not physical. It's not even based on the physical possessions that we have. Again, comfort is based on physical possessions. And God has promised, Jesus said that if we seek the kingdom first, all of our needs will be provided. Key word is needs. And but contentment is not just something we can work up or think up one day a year when we start trying to list the things we're thankful for. Contentment is a condition of our heart. It's a spiritual condition. And when we have that sense of contentment, then we know it has to be based on our faith that God would never leave us, that he would never forsake us. So I mentioned 1 Timothy chapter 6. We'll just look at it quickly as we start to conclude. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Paul actually had quite a lot to say about being content. Jesus did also. He mentioned more than once not to be wrapped up in the cares of this life. He talked about the deceitfulness of riches that choke out the spiritual life of those who are caught up in it. I like that phrase, deceitfulness of riches, basically telling us that money is a lie. It's deceitful. It makes us think that we might be able to achieve certain kind of happiness or success, when in fact it only becomes a burden. 1 Timothy chapter 6, godliness with contentment is great gain. If we can have this this condition, and again, it's a spiritual one, to be one who is seeking after and looking for God's will and applying God's way in our lives, do that in a way that is that also illustrates this quality of being content. That's the great gain. It's not. It's kind of a play on words. The gain is not money, is not physical wealth, but the gain is a spiritual one. When we truly seek God and we're content with Him and His way, then we've really made a profit. Then we've really accomplished something. For we brought nothing into this world, and it's certain we'll take nothing out. We've heard that many times. And we know the stories of the guys who were buried with their sports cars or with their piles of money or whatever it might be. But when life is over, it's all gone. Jesus spoke of the rich fool that had so much he couldn't build enough warehouses to store it. And Jesus said to him, "You fool, this night your life will be taken from you." We know these things, that physical wealth is not something that really brings satisfaction. But still, I think the warning is there in Hebrews 13, that we still have to be aware of and to fight the tendency of covetousness. Because anybody can be drawn into it. We brought nothing in the world, we'll take nothing out. Verse 8, having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. With these we shall be content. We'll be satisfied. We'll recognize that God has provided that, and He's provided it for us so that we can accomplish His will. Those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a trap. Again, there's the deceitfulness of wealth. It's a snare. It's a trap. And into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. The love of money is the root of all evil. These are statements and principles that we're familiar with, and I don't mean to imply, as we review these, that we are all caught up in it in that way. But I wanted to draw the contrast between what's happening in general, what people tend to do, with the spiritual condition of truly being content, which we can have as we understand and realize what God has promised to us. So we'll conclude back in Hebrews 13 again, where we started. Hebrews 13. That our conduct will be without covetousness. Our conduct is a reflection of everything that we do. The word literally means our citizenship. It means the way that we live our lives in the community, the example that we are to others, as well as simply the kind of people that we are and the way that we live from one day to the next, that we live in a way that shows that we no longer have that physical human weakness of covetousness, but rather we're content with such things as we have. God has given us what we have. God has a purpose that He's working in our lives. And we are grateful and appreciative and satisfied with what God has given to us, because we know this promise is true, that I will never leave you or forsake you. So we have that trust, we have that confidence, we have that faith, and we are continually practicing and learning a lesson which flies right over the head of people around us on a day such as Thursday, a day of Thanksgiving. But we can be thankful on a much deeper level, not in the superficial way that others may experience it, that we understand and we appreciate and we are not just grateful to God, but we are satisfied with what God has given to us, because we know that God would never leave us or forsake us.
Thank you, Mr.